Welcome to the House of Mary OMD podcasting series, Beyond Consecration to Jesus Through Mary. Help the Theotokan spread devotion to the Mother of God and her messages. Share this free audio link and other items from the website. And now, episode 2, Who is Mary?
The Tuesday talks, Living a Marian Life, will be shorter than my talks on the other days of the week to allow time for a rosary and fellowship. But these talks will be more intense because I know that most of you have been striving already to live a Marian life for quite some time. For at least 3 years, some of you here have been meeting weekly to pray the rosary and share with one another the insights that you've acquired to help one another grow closer to Mary. And that's why you're here tonight, to pick up insights to help you deepen your union with Mary. But what is driving you and so many other people? We are not alone. There are hundreds of thousands of men, women, and children in every nation today who also feel that they need to become closer to the Mother of God. What's the end game here? Is there some personal advantage we're hoping for? A shortcut to heaven? If you read classical spiritual books, you'll get the impression that this movement toward union with Mary is as old as the church itself. After all, the apostles were gathered around her on Pentecost. She was the rock at the foot of the cross, while Peter, the rock, crumbled. Many saints along the centuries have declared that imitation of Mary's virtues is the sure road to holiness for oneself, while other saints urged us to have recourse to Mary for her maternal intercession to obtain graces for others. In the Middle Ages, there was a custom of a feudal oath to Mary as one's sovereign queen. The Carmelites in the 1200s phrased their vows to God and the Blessed Virgin Mary. The oath was a promise to do something, to serve, to obey. Consecration is a step further. It's a gift of one's entire being. Consecration to Jesus through Mary is basically the brainchild of St. Louis-Marie Grignon de Montfort. Spoiler, his radical ideas got him poisoned by Jansenist Catholics, so he died in his 40s. Consecration was a new idea, and it seemed unbalanced. Even today, it's hard to understand it. St. Louis de Montfort wrote many books on Mary, but his jewel of jewels was true devotion to Mary. He knew this book would be resisted by hell itself. He said, "I clearly foresee that raging brutes will come in fury to tear with their diabolical teeth this little writing, or at least to enclose it in the silence of a coffer in order that it may not appear." Yet St. Louis was confident it would eventually bear fruit. He was right. In the confusion of the times, his book lay buried throughout the French Revolution and beyond. He died April 28, 1716. 126 years later, it was discovered by one of his own de Montfort priests. The year was 1842. This year is significant. We'll come back to 1842 in a minute. If you look at your miraculous medal, 1830 is inscribed on it, the year that the Blessed Virgin first delivered a public message for the world. She chose a young farm girl postulant, St. Catherine Labouré. Her confessor and her religious superiors didn't know what to think. There were no precedents, no Lourdes or Fatima or Rwanda yet, no way to look back and see how to handle messages for the world. This was new territory in spiritual direction. Were they to take this young postulant seriously? After a couple of years of hesitation, the confessor presented the dilemma to the Archbishop of Paris. He decided to allow some medals of the Immaculate Conception to be made and distributed, but without letting people know where they had come from. There were miracles right away, but the medal exploded in popularity in 1842. At the beginning of this year, a pious young man cajoled his Jewish friend to wear this new medal. Alphonse scoffed at all religion, but his friend kept daring him to put it on. Alphonse had only worn it a few days, maybe it was a few hours, I didn't go back and check the details, when Mary appeared to him exactly as she was depicted on the medal. She did not say anything, but light poured into his mind, and he instantly understood many truths of the faith. He wanted immediate baptism. Then he converted his brother. And then they both entered the seminary and were ordained for the Holy Land. This whole thing became a sensation throughout Rome and then Europe. The Pope actually stepped in to get some verification on this private revelation. Now, even grown men of the educated upper class were talking about the medal. So right at this sensational moment, there was another sensation. The original French version of True Devotion began to be read by everyone, at least in France. It was discovered that very year. A new appreciation of Mary was born. Thousands of French Catholics joined Thousands of French Catholics joined a confraternity of the Blessed Virgin Mary, I think it was, to consecrate themselves to Mary and to endeavor to be pleasing to her. In 1858, just 16 years later, Bernadette of Lourdes described a lady in a grotto wearing a white dress and a blue sash. And some suggested it was a deceased child of Mary, because that's the garb they wore in processions. So the medal had begun this whole movement of children of Mary. And the church had entered the modern Marian era with a bang. The next sensation was an apparition of Mary at La Salette in 1846, then Lourdes in 1858, then Pont-Mont, and on, right up to the approved apparitions of Rwanda, where Mary sang and danced with high school girls in Equatorial Africa. And then she went on to warn the country, which was about 90% Catholic, that if the tribes did not practice authentic charity and forgiveness, their country would deteriorate into violence. And it happened 10 years later. So this new era of apparitions with messages for the world was accompanied from the beginning by the writings and insights of St. Louis-Marie de Montfort. This is January 27th now, today, and I wanted to mention, we're beginning all these talks today, which is the feast, the anniversary of St. Therese's clothing. If you might remember, she prayed for snow on that day, and she got snow, which snow isn't really common in France, and so it was considered quite an interesting sign for her. And so it was a day for her beginning. She received the Carmelite habit, and we're beginning this endeavor now to talk about Mary all winter long. And St. Therese really talked about she wanted to live in the times to come when she knew there would be a time of persecution of Christians. And so I think the fact that we just happen to be starting today, I think that's evidence that she's walking with us. And we're also now in this year of the anniversary of Fatima. This is the centenary of one of the richest Marian apparitions. Where was de Montfort in 1917? Where were his writings? Had they lost interest? Had they gotten out of France? They were in Dublin, Ireland. A young civil servant named Frank Duff was working in the St. Vincent de Paul Society. Frank was introduced to a book by a friend. It was The True Devotion to Mary. Frank began to give talks on it. People desired to put that devotion into practice. A meeting was arranged, 8 p.m., September 7th, 1921, the eve of Our Lady's birthday. The Legion of Mary was born. The Legion is almost 100 years old now. In the era around World War II, it was a massive worldwide movement where lay people did dangerous work as missionaries in countries like China. They translated de Montfort's work into nearly every language around the globe. I was a member of the Legion as a teenager, and I made the consecration. I deliver and consecrate to thee as thy slave my body and soul, my goods, both interior and exterior, and even the value of all my good actions, past, present, and future. I leave to thee the entire and full right to dispose of me and all that belongs to me without exception, as thou pleasest, to the greater glory of God. Most of you here already know those lines because you've already done that. And I went on to become a Carmelite and pronounce my futile oath to God and Blessed Virgin Mary. But I was a closet rebel. I wanted to love Mary, but I felt offended by Mary. Why was this Galilean girl in the middle of my union with God? I didn't get it. All the books I read, even De Montfort, kept affirming her prerogatives, her graces, her holiness. But all the theology books I read made it sound like God chose her arbitrarily. Who was Mary? It seemed to me that she was just lucky. Somebody had to be the mother of baby Jesus. Life is a roll of dice, isn't it? We can't control who our parents will be, whether we'll be handicapped or get a good education. I know a friend of mine who's flown all over the world told me that to be born in the United States was to win a lottery ticket. She was dumbfounded at how much we have compared to most people whose primary occupation is to find food for the day. Today, 21,000 people will die of hunger and 125,000 will be aborted. Was Mary just lucky to get picked for the best job ever, Mother of God and Queen of Heaven and Earth? Was God reduced to making his selection from the small number of eligible girls who lived in Israel around 1 AD? Or can God decide to place persons to be born in certain eras? This question was important to me, because as hard as I tried, I just couldn't conjure up much respect for someone who got a free ride to holiness. It was hampering my devotion to Mary. So I invested a lot of time delving into the theology of predestination and how it works in tandem with our free will. But that's an intense subject, so I'll save that for another talk. Suffice it to say that I finally became convinced that Mary and Joseph and Peter and Andrew were all placed in Israel, just as you and I have been placed in this country in this era of history. We each have a divinely given mission, a role to play. At last, I came to be convinced that Mary was chosen because she was the most worthy person in all creation. In Carmel, we go into extra solitude twice a year for 10 days, once for a community retreat and once for a private retreat. During the annual private retreat, except for mass and community meals, I could spend the entire day in a hermitage surrounded by three lakes, 90 acres of woods, and 900 entertaining squirrels. When I was about 36 or 37, about 20 years ago, because I'm 57 now, my private retreat encompassed the Feast of the Immaculate Heart of Mary. It was Saturday afternoon of that feast day, and I was in prayer. Suddenly, I was drawn into experience that changed my life. I seemed to be given an experience of a participation in the heart of Mary. I was drawn into her prayer. She was focused on the pain of Yahweh. From the Garden of Eden onwards, Yahweh had tried to give himself in friendship to mankind. But down through the ages, mankind, as a body, had not received his love. Have you ever done some historical research on Mary's particular era? The local king was a half-Jew who had murdered several people in his family. Millions in the world were living under the yoke of Roman, Gentile, pagan domination. It was basically a mafia business. Pay me taxes and I'll protect you from other countries. The Jewish high priesthood was auctioned off by the Romans year by year to the highest bidder, when according to the Levitical law, it was supposed to be a lifetime office appointed by the Jewish king. The banking corruption in the temple was scandalous. Most of the priests were Sadducees who openly stated that they didn't believe in large portions of the Old Testament. For example, they rejected all passages that mentioned angels. There was a lot of materialism in Mary's day. Many Jews just wanted God to bless their country and give them a nice life. Not much love of the true God among the people who had entered into covenant with Yahweh to be a witness to him before the pagan world. It was really beyond sad. Yet I clearly perceived that Mary's pain wasn't sad for herself, but for God. Her empathy for the pain of his rejection became so intense that it rose to a pitch and threatened to destroy her. She was only human, and this was the pain of a divinity. I was feeling drawn into that pain of God, and it was starting to become a scary vortex when something happened. Yahweh couldn't bear to see Mary in such agony. But the only way to stop her pain was to stop his own, because it was his pain that was paining her. She was grieving that he hadn't been received by mankind. And so in that moment, God had compassion on her, and she conceived the love of God. In her own humanity, God was finally fully received by a human being. The agony merged into mutual ecstasy. This was the context of the incarnation as it was revealed to me that day. Okay, where is the part with the Archangel Gabriel asking her to become the mother of God? Behold, you will conceive in your womb and bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus. Actually, the angel never asked her. He just presumed on her consent, like it was already a done deal. He had already said that she was full of grace, and the Lord was with her. Perhaps in that moment of agony and ecstasy, she had conceived God in her heart, or maybe actually in the flesh also, but she didn't realize it, or it didn't happen until the angel told her about it. I'm not asking you to believe my personal understanding of the Annunciation, but I share it because I want you to benefit from a new perspective on this woman, who was often portrayed as a spineless, uneducated, simple girl who was amazed to be chosen to have a baby who was the Son of God. Could it be that God was responding to the desires of an intensely passionate woman who was a true daughter of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Those chosen patriarchs put up with all sorts of hardships and painful trials because of their hope that God would empower their descendants to become a blessing for all the families of the earth. Those men were selfless, strong, admirable. Saint Therese, we mentioned today, was another passionate soul. She wrote in her autobiography that her desire to save souls was a veritable martyrdom, killing her. She too was in agony until God blessed her. She would proclaim in her writings that Saint John of the Cross was right when he said that the soul obtains from him as much as it hopes for from him. And on the same theme of strong confidence in God, I'll throw in that St. Teresa of Avila kept telling her daughters to pray for great things because God is a great God. Mary's intense desire wasn't fully alleviated that day, though, because the reception of Jesus was far from 100% in her day and even up into the present. She lives in perpetual ecstasy in heaven in her union with God. But she also lives in perpetual union with the agony of our God because she shares his desire for union with every soul. As in Revelation 12, she is the great woman in the heavens, always in labor over souls. She is always presenting her pain to him, really his own pain, to ask him to draw down the Holy Spirit on souls who are far from his grace. And he is always bending over her to take away her pain by offering fresh graces to those who had resisted grace. During that experience, I practically melted into a puddle there in the Hermitage. It was so amazing. I perceived Mary as a towering inferno of goodness, love, joy, and agony. I wanted to relieve her of her burden, even as she endeavored to relieve Yahweh. The demand for consecration was no longer enough for me. I didn't want to just belong to Mary, to allow her to use me to help her save souls. No, I wanted to be one with her, to participate in her agonizing heart. But I held back. Surely my desires were going too far. Perhaps this was heresy. Was I being carried away by my emotions? I talked about it with my confessor, but he assured me that I couldn't love Mary too much. But I replied that he didn't understand what I was asking. So I blamed myself. I needed to describe that experience more precisely. Week after week, I tried to add another nuance in human vocabulary to an impossibly subtle and spiritual experience, but he kept laughing at me and telling me that it was impossible to love Mary too much. So I told him that I was done with him and I'm going to find another confessor. And he actually recommended a good Carmelite monk twice his age, who had a lot of experience in these things, a very Marian man. But the whole scenario was repeated. He too said, I couldn't love Mary too much. But it wasn't about love. It was about union with a mere human being. Was this heresy or was it not? I had no choice but to research the problem myself. Fortunately, we had a marvelous library in that monastery, and the monks nearby had an even larger library. And I began to take notes as I read book after book after book. We only had manual typewriters at that time, and for paper we had to cut up brown paper bags or use labels off of cans. I had spent my first 13 years in another Carmel, which had a softer concept of poverty, and I began to badly miss my old computer to help me deal with all these notes. And suddenly the monks next door voted to embark on a large liturgy project. They approached my prioress. If they provided the computer, could Sister Anne be their secretary? The new computer came equipped with Bible software that included multiple translations in several languages, 4 Greek and Hebrew lexicons, concordances, and commentaries. In the same month, a businessman happened to donate reams and reams of paper. I was going to need all this. Years of research lay ahead of me, and I dove into it with enthusiasm. The treatises on Mary, written over the centuries, were sporadic and superficial. I realized I had to begin from the beginning. Mary's role was to be the new Eve, but the old Eve dropped out so early that we never saw what her vocation was supposed to look like. I can't remember now, but it took 1 year, I think it took 3 years of study, but I did reach a moment there where I could make that deeper consecration, namely to at least offer myself to be fully united with her and to share her pain. That moment came during a subsequent retreat when I kept saying, I want to be Mary. It was crazy, and I was laughing at the absurdity, but I could not get rid of this desire. To distract myself, I walked into the library, reached up high at random, and pulled some book off the shelf. I opened to a passage of St. Maximilian Kolbe telling his monks, brothers, you must be Mary. You must preach about Mary. You must not stop talking about Mary, because so far, nothing about Mary has been said. It was hyperbole. Much had been written about Mary over the centuries, but it was only the tip of the iceberg. It was going to take much more prayer, reflection, and study to gain a better understanding of her place in the church. Later on, I'll approach the question, who is Mary, from a doctrinal, scriptural, or theological context, but I wanted to focus today on Mary's personality. I don't want her to be a stranger on a pedestal for you or some remote hero in the clouds. I wanted you to see that she's alive, an intense person, greatly interested in a personal relationship with each of you. She's not limited by space and time like we are. I want to conclude with a gospel confirmation of the idea that we can really be identified with Mary. You may be familiar with the theological tradition that a priest is identified with Jesus in a special way. Here's a quote from Pope St. John Paul II. Dear friends, you are ontologically configured to Christ the priest, to him, head and shepherd, which is why we say in all truth, with the whole of tradition, that every priest is alter Christus. At the moment of ordination, you receive a new mode of being. He said that in 1999. Alter Christus is Latin for another Christ. It's hinted at in St. Paul, and I could refer you to entire documents on that subject. But do you know that the gospel itself speaks of Altera Maria, another Mary? Let me quote. First, there's John 19, which alludes to it. Standing by the cross of Jesus were his mother, Mary, and his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. That's three Marys at the foot of the cross, the mother of God, the repentant Magdalene, and then this third Mary. Matthew 27. And they rolled a great stone to the door of the tomb and departed. But Mary Magdalene and the other Mary, it's Altera Maria in the Vulgate, were there, sitting opposite the sepulchre. Matthew 28. Now after the Sabbath, toward the dawn of the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary, Altera Maria, went to see the sepulchre. If you feel drawn to live a Marian life, you are drawn to be an Altera Maria.